So my past manager, Daniel Pohl, who's sitting in the audience, would never think I was up here, nor would myself, since I was always afraid of doing partner notifications over the phone. I feared it. It was a phobia. And here I am with an awesome case to share with you all. All right, so like Gordon said, my name is Richie Diestreft. I'm a nursing graduate student at DePaul University. And I have the pleasure today to represent Howard Brown Health Center, where I worked as a disease intervention specialist, DIS, for 2 years. I'm going to be discussing successful syphilis disease intervention, linking a large high-risk sexual network of men who have sex with men, or MSM. To begin, Howard Brown Health Center is one of the largest lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender-focused health organizations in the nation. It is comprised of 3 different clinics: the Broadway Youth Center for those under the age of 25, Triad, which is our primary care health practice, and then our main hub, Howard Brown Health Center, which has the walk-in clinic but also primary care and other services. At this time, during the study, our syphilis elimination team consisted of 3 full-time disease intervention specialists who were culturally competent regarding the LGBT community, and we were funded by the Chicago Department of Public Health Syphilis Elimination Program. The DIS contact tracing process at Howard Brown involved interviewing syphilis-infected individuals, educating them regarding the signs, symptoms, and treatment of syphilis, and then eliciting any partners to find the source of their infection and anyone whom they might have infected. Between the months of January and October 2010, our team was successful in linking 33 men who have sex with men in a high-risk sexual network. We utilized an alphabetic lot system in which we often, on a normal basis, would link between 1 to 4, give or take, infected partners. However, this was a unique case in which we identified 26 partners from letters A through Z and then had to restart the alphabet with double letters ending at HH. Today I will be discussing the demographic and behavioral risks among this sexual network and the strategies which made us successful in identifying and treating those who are infected. Now, there's a ton of data that we have, but I'll be focusing on the information that I, as someone who's not an epidemiologist, understands, but then also what I found most interesting and pertinent. All the data was collected from required Centers for Disease Control and Prevention interview record forms, in addition to our enhanced interview forms. Patients were identified through the STI walk-in clinic, the primary care clinic at Howard Brown and Triad, and local private practitioner offices based on the sexual relationship to the network. Within the sample of 33 MSM, the median age was 30 years old, with the majority being of the Caucasian race. 70% were HIV positive, with 5 individuals who were found to be newly positive within the last year. I believe we identified 2 or 3 HIV positive individuals at the time of syphilis test. 42% were diagnosed with early latent syphilis, another 42% were presenting secondary symptoms, and the remainder were presenting primary syphilis symptoms. It is also worth mentioning, and I was excited about this, that, sadly enough, it's kind of in a sick way, one patient had a dual diagnosis of secondary syphilis and also neurosyphilis, which was verified through a lumbar puncture after he was experiencing vision loss. In regards to the risk factors, some commonalities were that 88% identified participating in anonymous sex, and that same amount admitted to meeting sexual partners using the internet. There was little difference between anal sexual practice roles. However, inconsistent condom use was extremely common, with 1/4 of individuals admitting to never using condoms. In regards to substance use, 90% of the 33 MSM reported substance use during sexual intercourse or prior. Interestingly enough, the second most commonly used substance after alcohol was crystal meth or methamphetamine, followed by poppers or nitrates. Through previous Howard Brown data, it had been determined that MSM who reported using methamphetamine during the last year had over 3 times the odds of being diagnosed with syphilis than MSM who did not report any meth use. In regards to partner elicitation, while there were a total of 114 partners elicited, 93 were unique patients since we excluded those who were already named on multiple cases or multiple occasions. 24 partners were elicited during original interviews. However, it gets interesting that there was more success during the 73 total re-interviews, where we were able to elicit 90 additional partners. Re-interviews were not only performed in person, which kind of steers away from the traditional DIS protocol, I guess, but also over phone and especially email. While looking at the partner field record dispositions, which can be a little confusing for non-DIS, but I'll make it brief, almost 30% of elicited partners were preventatively treated, whereas 13.5% were infected and later brought to treatment, and 18% were previously treated at the time of notification. So we had pretty good success within this high-risk network. When discussing partner notification methods for all of the partners, the majority were notified over the phone, as we would expect. However, it was important to note that a large amount, 42 partners of the group, were contacted via using the internet. Now, if we break that down a little further, in regards to internet partner notification among the syphilis-infected individuals, 88% reported meeting sexual partners online. Surprisingly, the majority were notified through a popular single bareback website. The rest were notified somewhat equally through other sex-seeking websites and also social networking websites. Here I took hours to create this sexual network map or diagram. I'm a little anal. There were, and you can count them, 93 total individuals who were elicited, with 33 syphilis-positive patients noted by the orange circles. The 23 HIV-positive individuals have the red letter in the circle. Arrows were used to point to whom who had identified or named that individual during the interview, both during the original interview and the re-interview. Connected to the orange circles or infected patients are blue circles, which indicated sexual partners who tested negative at the time of their visit, while green circles unfortunately indicated those who were not tested due to refusal or insufficient information that was given during the interview. While DIS did not focus on eliciting any clusters, since we already had plenty of work ahead of us, it is important to also note that we did have 5 clusters. Clusters are basically individuals who are elicited from those who are infected but never had sexual relationships with them. So basically friends that might benefit from a test. Excuse me. A few considerations is that our program has limited restrictions on case closure deadlines, unlike a lot of other programs. This required more time and resources because it allowed, you know, us to have more success reaching out to partners, but also more time in the office. In addition, this created a sense of rapport and trust between the DIS and the patient. I was personally influenced to bring several individuals in for other services, such as drug abuse programs, HIV case management, and primary care, especially after testing positive at the time of syphilis treatment and testing. Lastly, all data was gathered based on the patient's word during the interview. Now, this success in disease intervention demonstrates a few conclusions. First, the need that there is to adapt traditional DIS techniques to include the internet or other sources of technology. It is always important to inquire about online partners, even if your clinic is not able to provide those notifications. There are other sites that often can. And this can be done through website messaging, online chat, and even text messaging if feasible. Our clinic was fortunate enough to have computers with internet access in every interview room, which allowed me to sit with the client himself, and he was able to go onto the websites and point out who he had been with during a certain amount of time or during that interview period. In addition, we often followed up with patients to perform re-interviews, which again, as I stated previously, were not only done over the phone, but also via email. When this was done, instead of, you know, saying when you were in my, kind of prodding the individual and saying when you were in Miami 2 months ago, who did you have sex with at that time? And the email would be much more vague, and we would say, let's talk about those individuals that you had promised to share with me. In addition, it is important to acknowledge the existence of gatekeepers, and I know many of us have heard this term. Often, factors such as income, age, and living status play a role in identifying more partners, and I found this true to be true in this sexual network. For example, older, more successful businessmen were identified who would hold sex parties for younger individuals and supply the drugs at those parties. By building a trusting relationship with these individuals, we were able to tap further into this high sexual network to elicit partners. The interesting thing is also these individuals, more often than not, had phone numbers or at least screen names for these individuals that I could use to contact them because they were often having these parties every so often or more frequently. With this said, DIS always need to be culturally competent by using appropriate terminology that's used by the actual sexual network and should work as a team. So, for instance, when I didn't have success with one of the individuals, I passed him on to his FR, field record, on to my coworker who could try a different way of eliciting partners or trying to get through to him. A few implications for future research is to initiate partner notifications online, especially as you saw with bareback websites, and it can be tricky for sure. In addition, offer other services beyond simple syphilis treatment. We know that it's always not just syphilis treatment that these individuals need or would benefit from. There's a lot of other factors involved. This can include drug abuse programs, HIV-positive groups, things of that sort. A phone call, email, or text message can be done at every 3, 6, and 12 months post-treatment, and we actually used our medical record system, our electronic medical record system, to give us a little bling when it came time for them to retest. This is especially important not only to keep that kind of friendship between the DIS and the actual individual, but then also to decrease the chance of reinfection and to verify that treatment was actually effective. This can be very difficult among HIV-positive individuals. As we know, they often don't respond as we would like them to with syphilis treatment. Unfortunately, several individuals did become reinfected within a year and were not included in this presentation, but we already had several other screen names and contact information from the previous kind of prodding and investigation that we had done to make it a lot easier to bring them in for testing and treatment. All right, so with that said, I want to acknowledge and thank my collaborators, especially Daniel Pohl, Mark Pineda, this is not the Grammys, I know, Anna Hotton, who's our epidemiologist, and then the Chicago Department of Public Health and Illinois Department of Public Health, who we match up well with, and they helped us greatly. So I will take questions if there's time, as long as you're gentle.
Thanks,
it's finals week.
Very nice. We have about 5 minutes for questions. Go ahead.
Hi, that was a great presentation. I have a quick question for you, and I hope you can answer it. I'm also a DIS, and I work in Detroit. You were talking about doing the re-interview by emailing, and you also talked about text. What ways did you use confidentiality to, you know, contact either partners or OPs? Because sometimes somebody else can end up seeing that. And
I hear you. Yes, right. For sure. Probably, we rarely use text messaging unless I really knew that individual and really knew there were partners that he was still not passing on to me. Also, it was an issue with text messaging, and I crack up about it, because a lot of them had Cricket phones or phones that were temporarily connected, and then you lose contact with them completely. Surprisingly enough, with the internet, they often kept reading their bareback websites, emails, and messages. So you always want to have backup contact methods. One of those things was email. So during the original interview, I would obviously, depending on what they want to give you, and later on in the interview, once you build that confidence and trust, to ask them for their email and say, you know, I would like to follow up with you. I will not put any confidential information in that email, but just asking you to give me a call back. And that allows me to make sure that the treatment was actually effective, so you're no longer going to be showing any symptoms. And that usually kind of turns their key to make them think, yeah, I probably don't want these nasty rashes on my palms anymore. You know, so really influencing them to say, you know, this is all a sexual network, you're all related, and you're not alone in this. And so we really need to work to keep you healthy, but then also from you infecting people or you becoming reinfected, you know, because it's all interrelated. So you have to not only bring up their own issues, because at times definitely there are individuals who said, I don't care about my sexual partners, all I care about is myself. Yeah, it's going to happen. But you always want to bring it back to the greater good of the community.
Okay, let's go here and then over there.
Thank you for the presentation.
I can't hear you. Thank you.
I'm sorry. Okay. Brian Sorrell, New York City. I'm kind of impressed with the partner notification aspect of it, and the dispositions that you got are fantastic. Mm-hmm. My question is, for the locating information that you received upon interview, what was the primary source of information that you received as far as was it traditional or was it more internet-based, or is it the kind of thing where you had an internet contact and you converted it into traditional information?
Good question.
So what did you have when you started out with?
Good question. In DIS lingo, we always had the information. If we were given a screen name and no other contact information, we would create a buff form. And from that buff form, we would attempt through the different websites to notify those partners. Once we were able to notify those partners through our profiles, and they would often give us a call back, and through caller ID we were able to create an FR based off the number that they called us from. Sometimes they would call, you know, with the blocked number, but still, at least you're able to talk to that person and at least scream out what you're notifying them about once you knew you had the correct person on the line. Sometimes you would even, if you don't have a first name because it is so anonymous within the barebacking community, you can even ask them what their screen name is. I mean, sometimes you do what you have to do, but if that's all you have, you want to be sure you're talking to the correct person who's calling.
So just to clarify, so if the person was an internet contact, you didn't consider them, you never initiated a traditional FR?
No. No FRs were created unless we had something other than a screen name, basically. Mm-hmm. Always phone number, not even email as well.
Okay, let's go over here.
Great presentation. Thank you very much. My name is Bob. I'm from Navy and Marine Corps Public Health Center. I'm curious, during the original interview with your prevention counseling, do you use the RESPECT model, or is there some other approach that you use?
Unfortunately, I do not know what that model is, so you can always explain that to me. I'm sure my boss is laughing at me right now.
It's a certain counseling and testing protocol as well.
Oh, okay. Not that I'm aware of. We were pretty flexible, and each of us DIS had a totally different method of how we went about asking questions, and I think it really matched our personality as well. So, I mean, you can have a type of model, but I feel like within the gay community or MSM community, you have to be really careful about how you go about things. Luckily, at that time, all three of us DIS were gay-identifying males, so that did help since we were part of the community. But definitely, I feel like anybody can be just as successful.
Okay, let's take two more questions. We'll start over here.
First of all, great work. My question is, how soon after your original interview did you conduct a re-interview, and was there a difference for the client or the outcomes that you had with partner elicitation?
That's an excellent question. It really varied from individual to individual. I was pretty quick on the ball about getting in touch with them, especially individuals who were in the secondary stage of syphilis, and I warned them about the Herxheimer reaction. And so I kind of used that, sadly enough, as a method to recontact them and say, hey, how are you feeling? Did you have any type of reaction? Often a lot of these individuals also wanted to go back to doing drugs or using, you know, other substances. And so I would try to influence them and say, try your best to hold off because we're not sure how that might react with the antibiotics. So that, I mean, I don't know how effective that was, but it really varied from individual to individual, but I would often contact them 2 days later at the earliest, and others I would wait a little bit longer. If they promised me an email of screen names or partner emails, then I would wait a little bit longer, and during the actual interview, I would set a date of when they're going to get that to me by, and if they didn't get back to me with that information, I was contacting them that day.
Okay, final question over here, and if there are any additional questions, come on up after.
Thank you.
Rebecca Jordan, Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment, and it sounds like you are a great DIS, so thanks for
that. I'm retired now.
My question, I realize this was a syphilis investigation, but obviously you identified some persons who had knowledge of their HIV infection status, and you also identified some persons who previously were unaware of their HIV infection status. I can't remember exactly how Chicago or Illinois handles issues of non-disclosure, but did that come up at all in your investigation where there were persons who knew they were HIV infected and were having unprotected, bareback.com, having unprotected sex with others, and was there any disclosure discussion that happened as part of any of the risk reduction counseling that you did?
Excellent question. Yes, that definitely skewed the way that I went about asking questions. Some of the individuals were very straightforward about their HIV status, whereas others, it even took 2 months for them to acknowledge their HIV status and share it with me. So it really varied. However, I think I went about it in a way that, I'm looking at this further, to be honest with you, for future research, but one of the issues was that a lot of individuals who practice bareback sex or use the popular bareback website, they solely had sex with others who were HIV positive.
So then you know there's disclosure.
Right, and I would take that towards, you know, I would take that with a grain of salt. I mean, during my education part of the interview, yeah, you have to make it brief so they don't go bored, but I did bring up that you want to be sure that even if you're having sex with other HIV-positive individuals, the disadvantage of that due to treatment, etc. But there were other individuals who, one in particular, it took me 3 months to actually get him to do an HIV test, and he figured he was positive and just didn't want to know. But eventually, once I was able to bring that wall down, he opened up a lot more. So it really, again, I feel like I'm repeating myself in that it varies from person to person. But in regards to the different laws and such, I'm more focused on each person individually and what they were really having trouble with. So if they had trouble disclosing their status, we tried to work on that during the interview.
Thank you.
Okay,
thanks,
Richie.
Thank you.
I'd also